You're listening to the Brave Parent Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Maples. I'm here for all parents who deeply love their children and want their health span to equal their lifespan. In other words, to be healthy their entire lives. If that's you, tune in. In every episode, we're grappling with contemporary issues that affect every child every day in areas that your doctors either don't know or don't have time to tell you. It's your time to be brave. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to season two of the Brave Parent Podcast. Today, Lauren and I have a very special guest and a good friend of mine, Dr. Amy Wisner, who teaches in the Department of Business Communications at the Broad College at Michigan State University. And she is known as the Rebel Professor. And we'll talk, she'll introduce herself in just a minute. But I just wanted to say how excited I am today waking up thinking about this podcast, because I learned so much from Amy. And I know Lauren will too, as she's raising two young children. And so is Amy. But we're really talking today about social emotional health, and that is authenticity. We're going to talk about how to grow truly authentic children who know who they are and who are able to live their life, not just their childhood, to their fullest potential, to serve the world and with their unique purpose. And how do you create that in younger ages? And then also, we're going to shift gears partway through and talk about our whole system of learning based around grades. And is that really the best way for kids to learn? And are we punished by the reward of a grade, or are we inhibited by that? And what does that do to our learning? And that's something that Amy has a very unique and special, not only focus on, but a lot of experience at. So having said that, Amy, tell us a little bit about you.
Thank you, Susan. I'm excited to be here too. I was also very excited when I saw this on my calendar and remembered that we get to talk today. Let's see. I'm a single mom by choice through the miracle of science. I have a 4-year-old daughter and 2-year-old son, and I'm raising them solo, which is probably the bravest of all brave things I've ever done in my entire life. And also something that's really aligned with my true authenticity, my truth of who I am. I'm a professor of business communication at Michigan State University. I have 600 undergrads every semester, and really have taken this program from just sort of your traditional business communication to really helping my students figure out who they are and what they care about, what they truly care about, and how they want to have an impact in the world. And so much of those two roles are really what brought me to where I am right now. And so one of my friends and somebody who does amazing anti-racist work, Janelle Scales, said it perfectly: parenting radicalized me. Mm. I have seen things so much more clearly after having children and realizing areas where I wasn't living into my truth or my authenticity because I was raising these two little humans. And I mean, it really all started when I gave birth to Olivia. It was like this mama bear inside of me woke up, and it was just a whole different beast in the greatest way possible. But I truly have gone from, like, personally in my own journey toward authenticity, I will say. I mean, I think it's always a journey of unlearning what society, to include our parents and our grandparents and all of the systems around us, are telling us who we're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And really unlearning what we've bought into to really reconnect with who we are at the center of our being.
And you have such a unique perspective, Amy, because you're really catching kids as they leave our households, mm-hmm. and go off to college. Mm-hmm. They sit in front of you wide-eyed and open to, you know, that sort of strange abyss between being at home under these constructs and now being under the rules of a university, but still kind of protected.
Yeah.
And then you've had all these interesting experiences.
Yeah, I think what happened for me was I was struggling for a while. So I've been at Michigan State now for 11 years. I've been in the College of Business for five. And I was really struggling with the fact that it seemed like students were just not engaged in learning, that they were just hustling for the grade. And I mean, I guess so was I back in the day. Just what's the, you know, I refer to it as the capitalist exchange of grades, where like, what's the smallest amount of work that you can do to get the best reward, the biggest grade, the best grade. And so I would regularly be talking about things and talking about interpersonal communication skills. This is really nuanced. This is something that you can always be learning, always be improving. Who cares what the grade is? If I'm giving you feedback, it seems like you would want to know that. And it was like they were blinded by this need to accomplish the grade, you know, almost in an, you know, automaton fashion, right? Like must get the grade. And they couldn't even see the opportunity to learn. And it wasn't until I had my kids that I really started to see that we do this to them. We do this to people, right? We take these creative geniuses who are critical thinkers by nature. I mean, anyone who's around little kids knows why is the number one thing they ask. It's all the time. Explain things to me. I want to know everything. They're just naturally curious. They're natural learners.
Why? Why?
And then, but yeah, why? Why? Explain it. And I made a commitment to never set a rule for my kids if I couldn't explain the rationale behind it. Mm. If there wasn't some meaning behind it, otherwise that's just a power dynamic. That's just me telling you to do something because I think it's right. So to your point earlier, right versus wrong, who's to say what right versus wrong is? And so
I remember saying to my son a lot of times, like, because I'm large and in charge. And when he turned around and said that back to me, I was like, that's
great. Always comes back around.
It always does.
This little kid going, I'm large and in charge. I'm like, no, you're not. Neither am I. I don't know why yes. I said that.
Yeah. I have said since Olivia was very small that, that my job is to keep her healthy, safe, and growing. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm ever going to stop her from doing something that she wants to do, it is because it's not aligned with me accomplishing that goal. Mm. So I'm clearly not going to let her run out in the middle of traffic. And I'm going to make sure that she brushes her teeth, and I'm going to help her make sure that she has good, you know, hygiene habits in general. She's going to eat healthy foods and have a good relationship with what that means. You know, it's not, you just, these rules, especially around food. And we've talked about these things before so much. And your book does such a great job with helping people understand that, you know, if we treat certain foods like they're bad, then the relationship with it is different. If it's a matter of, okay, Caleb always wants to eat chocolate. Always. He's my chocolate kid. I want chocolate. Chocolate. And I always say, we're not going to do chocolate first because that's a lot of sugar. Let's eat something else. And then we can have some chocolate. And so yesterday he said, I want chocolate first. Right. And so he is starting to recognize that we're having this conversation around this and we're navigating and discussing why this is something that I'm trying to help him establish as a healthy habit, because his body and his health matter to me and ought to matter to him. Right. And so we discussed it and he said,
how old is he?
He's two, 2.5. And he said, okay. So, but it's
fiber first. That's what we talk about, right?
Right. Right. And
mitigates the sugar response.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so we discuss these things at a child appropriate level, right? For mm-hmm. them to start understanding that they do have agency and that they do have the ability to critically question everyone, every authority, and especially the number one authority figure in their life, which is me. Because if I'm not giving them permission to do that, why would I ever expect that they are going to do that in a classroom or in any other setting? They're not. They can't develop those skills until they have practice with it. And but I see, you know, with students, what I finally, it was almost like suddenly so clear to me that we take these curious learners and we sit them in militant little rows and tell them exactly what sliver of information they're supposed to know. And then what they're, give that back to me. Okay, here's your grade. And we do that. And then they get to me and they don't know the first thing about themselves. They ask me what they should be when they grow up. What, I don't know what to major in. And I ask them, who are you? What do you care about? And they don't know. And to be honest, like, there are a lot of grown-ups who also can't answer those questions, right?
Sure. And we also often have our parents' handprint on our back about what we should do when we grow up, the work we should choose, and what lifestyle we should be aiming for, and how much money we should be making. All of that is ingrained by these sort of subtle, you can do anything you want, you're so talented.
As long as it's really what you're going to do.
Little dangerous.
And some subtle, some not so subtle, because I have had crying students in my office who absolutely don't want to do anything in business. This is not their dream. They do not want to do this, but a parent or both parents are essentially forcing them to because they're paying for their education. And it's just devastating to me to think that somebody is going to live, because, you know, of course what you do, you go through 4 years of school and then you start your jobs and then you do that for 5 or 10 or more years, and then finally go like, nope, I still hate this. And now you have to start over.
And that's what's so powerful about what you're doing. I mean, yes, at the college level, but then so much of your other work is working with younger ages, because I mean, for me, even like that confidence and saying, this is what I want to do and why, it didn't come until I had my kids, those reflections, right? This is not who I am, because this is not who I want them to be. I need to start living my passion, right? It's doing what I feel called to do. But I mean, I didn't have my kids until I was in my 30s. So then that journey came for me in my 30s. And so as I'm listening to you, I'm like, what a gift to be able to give that to my kids. I mean, college now made a huge difference in my life. Earlier in life, even better.
And that's where I think for all of us as parents, we need to be doing the work of unlearning. If we want to raise generations of...
I love that. The work of unlearning.
Yeah. If we want to raise generations of children who are going to have this connection with self and a true understanding of who they are and how they want to show up in the world and what they truly value, not just what the rules are and how to follow rules, we have to do it differently. And we can't do that unless we unlearn a lot of stuff. Society has been packing information into our brains from every angle. And we do this. And especially us as women, we have this whole set of beauty industry standards that are just hammered into us. And then we keep doing all of that dirty work in our minds all the time.
We do. And we, you know, a society has its own pressures on men.
Absolutely.
I feel worse for men, because there's this whole sense of who are they if women are equal in the workforce and the science world and all that, and at home there's only one mom and there's only one housekeeper, you know, it's like we've really done it to men in some ways. But gender stuff aside, I look at my son and, you know, he super, super bright. And even by saying that, I'm probably being defensive to tell you that he lives this outdoor adventure life. And, you know, he's a professional athlete and guide, and, you know, now teaching wilderness outdoor medicine, getting EMT and thinking of firefighting and pilotry and all of this stuff. But in the meantime, he's a river guide. He's a ski coach. He does competitive mountain biking, all the stuff you really like worry about. My friends, when Hunter chose to do this after getting a really good education and, you know, an all A student at everything he's ever done, they're like, it's a phase. Don't worry. I'm like, not. I hope that his happiness isn't a phase.
I hope so too.
I hope that because he's happy and not drinking and drugging to numb himself and living his best life, I hope that's never a phase. And that's really what we're after. And of course, off my payroll, supporting himself, learning financial, you know, responsibility. It's at a young age. I mean, we have to help kids realize that they don't have to live our lifestyle. They just have to be able to support their own without being in debt and, you know, having anyway, but that whole area of trying to shape who kids belong or who they are. Tell me a little bit about your experience in maybe with an individual student or two students where you've really seen in a semester someone blossom as a result of the work that you're doing? Well, first say, like, I know we're going to run out of time.
What am I doing?
What are you doing that is unique that you're so far not getting kicked out of the university
for? So far.
Her nickname is, her handle is the Rebel Professor, and she really is rebellious. She's breaking all the rules. So tell us about your journey.
January of 2022, I scrapped all the content in the course and decided to help students really focus on identity and values and the value that they bring to any space, not just in the workplace. That's something that we don't create space for, is who are you and how do you show up everywhere across contexts? Who are you at the core of your being? And how do you want to show up in the world? And one of the really phenomenal things that I saw was the number of times when we did gratitude journaling. So I had them start journaling and learning about emotions and values and really thinking about their strengths and their superpowers and how they can use their superpowers for good. And so many students were saying things like, I need to spend more time with my mom. I need my mom to know how much I appreciate her. I go home and I always think it's annoying that my mom wants to talk to me, but the more work they did around this, the more they realized the value of not just moms, other, you know, I'm surely there were dads and everything, but I'm a mom. And so I heard the mom comments a lot. And I feel like I need to send a little you're welcome out to all the moms of the students who go through my class. And it's cool because it's easy, especially at that point in our lives as human beings, we're going through that individuation process. You've moved out of your home, you're starting to figure yourself out. And so you're really distancing yourself emotionally from your parent or parents, primary caregivers. And, but when you really think about what you care about, what do we really care about? It's the people in our lives. And when we investigate this, like, what are we grateful for? What do we really care about? What do we value? And then on the flip side of that, I ask everyone, right? How does society determine success? It's how much money do you make? How much status do you have? How much power do you have? How many cool cars do you have? What does your house look like, right?
Now, for you listeners, I want you to picture writing a project like this while you're in a business community. Right? Because our sense about successful in business is equated to money. So
totally.
Keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not until that point where they realize, look at this dichotomy of what really matters to us versus what we're told by society we're supposed to be chasing. And how do you remedy that? And for some people, they don't want to. That's okay. That's your choice, right? I want it to be something that people are very conscious of, that they're making life balanced choices, really value guided choices as they're going through their lives, personally and professionally, and really aligning with what does matter to them. And I think the most powerful story during that semester, during our first semester of doing this, was I was scared. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. I was absolutely terrified because we were talking about emotions. We were talking about, you know, core values and people over profits sorts of things, really centering humanity in our lives over business in a business school.
Back up for 1 second and tell them that there are no grades.
Yeah. Okay. So I also knew if I were doing this work, that the only way that I was going to get people to actually do the work and not just do it in a performative way was we couldn't have grades. And so I just did it as a completely ungraded format. And the students for 14 out of 15 weeks kept saying, oh, is this how you're going to grade us? I'm like, what? They don't trust anyone. They don't trust people, especially in the academy, rightfully so. And I kept saying, I don't know what I need to convince. You can have whatever grade you want, because honestly, if you're going to work the system, which is what they're trained to do, then what are you really learning anyway? So who cares? Can you get a 4 point in this class if I have grades? Yeah, people do it all the time. So just get rid of the grades and then we can get rid of this performative nature of things. And it took a full semester of doing that before people realized. And then the word gets around, you know, 600 people start telling their friends, this is no joke. She really isn't going to grade you. And she really is going to give you whatever grade you want at the end. And so people are like, well, doesn't that mean that students just don't do anything? Sometimes, yes, but we have enough call-in points where we can say, you know, how are you doing on your journey? What's coming up for you? And they're like, crickets, you know, that's also an opportunity for growth. That's also an opportunity for self-discovery. Because if you haven't done anything in a class where there are no grades and the only purpose is to figure out who you are and what you care about and how you're going to have an impact and you're not doing anything, investigate that. Why? Right? And often it's because I had these other things I had to do for my other classes that do have grades. That's our whole lives. We're performing to someone else's standards our entire lives until we decide what matters to us matters enough to not do that. And so, yeah, I definitely was scared during the first semester. And
that's crazy stuff.
It's still, yeah, for sure. The not going to administration and asking for permission part of it was the scariest, but I knew they would say no. I knew they would say, we can't do that. So I figured ask for forgiveness later. And it worked beautifully. Students who were, I mean, I had students who were like, I have literally never cracked a book. I've never done any of the things that you're asking me to do. I would have never done if this were graded, but I actually am buying in because you seem like you actually care about us figuring this out.
Yeah, that's powerful.
Yeah. And so I think the most, truly the most remarkable story was a student who came up to one of my teaching assistants at the end of the semester and said, before this class started, they were contemplating the ways that they could unalive themselves. Mm-hmm. And the first class, when they heard we were going to be doing this and that there were no grades, it was like the answer to some prayer or ask for a sign. And then suddenly this person was sitting in a seat with 600 people in this class. And by the end of the semester, they came up to the TA just to say, thank you for the work that you've done here. I've realized that I do actually have a purpose. Mm-hmm. And so
it's not about just the TA seeing them or you seeing them. It's about them seeing themselves for the first time.
Yeah.
And I had another student who, on a little lighter note, who said, wow, my whole life, everyone has always said, just be yourself. And no one until this class has asked me who I am.
Mm. Yeah.
We don't make space.
How do we, Amy, or Lauren, if you have ideas, what are the best ideas for helping children see who they are, even amidst the preteen adolescent years of knowing that conformity is what helps build acceptance and popularity? How do we help kids stand up for who they are, learn who they are, stand up for who they are, and really chart a unique course where they don't feel ashamed?
I'm not the expert here, but I'm just going to input something that I've been doing lately, and I've seen a huge change in my kids as a result. And that's going back to that whole why question. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been asking them the why question as well. And for them to start thinking through things like, why do I feel this way? Or why did I have this reaction? Or why, like the other day, they had pajama day for the school, right? And my six-year-old didn't want to wear pajamas. And I said, that's fine, but why don't you want to wear the pajamas, right? Yeah. Like, let's talk through that, what's actually happening there. And I was like, if you don't want to wear something that everyone else is wearing, that's totally fine. I just want you to feel secure in your reasoning behind it as well. Same thing when they ask me why questions, I'll be like, well, why do you, what do you think, right? As a result. So they're always thinking for themselves. And I've seen a huge change in just even, honestly, the respect levels lately.
Yeah.
It's been a huge shift. And I feel like their confidence in those decisions that they're making. So
empowering.
That's been one I've recently inputted.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah. I think that mindfulness and awareness is the first step for all of us as parents, mm-hmm. for our own unlearning and unpacking all of these, our own expectations, so that we can get out of their way and not put those things on them. Because so much of that is happening at a very unconscious level, that if we're not practicing that same mindfulness, then we impose our ideas on them. And on some level, that's going to happen by nature of our humanness, right? But I think the more time that we can spend in a state of mindfulness and awareness of our own thoughts and feelings and behaviors, the more that we can model that mindfulness for them. And so I think also giving them permission to push back and say, no, I regularly will ask Olivia, she's 4. No, okay, why not? And she'll give me a very reasonable explanation. And I'll say, okay, that makes sense to me. Yeah. That seems like a good reason. Go ahead.
I make the point in the book that listening to your child is truly an act of love, and it's truly an act of them feeling loved. Mm-hmm. And even after listening to them, if she said to you, well, I'd really like to race in front of cars to see if I'm fast enough to beat the traffic.
Which is not too much of a stretch. I know that you know her, so that's a very good
example. You could say, well, that's a reasonable request. I can see how that might be exciting, but I'm not going to allow you to do that. Yeah. It's not safe enough.
Yeah.
The fact that you listened and then still made a decision means that you garner, she feels loved, heard. But not just like end of discussion.
Yep.
You know, my way or the highway. I'm large, you know, that.
Yep.
So I think that's powerful. It takes time to listen to kids and listen to their reasoning. I also really find it powerful that we teach kids the range of emotions to describe, not just mad, sad, and angry. I'm sorry, mad, sad, and happy. I mean, those are the three that we typically focus on, but there are just a whole range of emotions that if they can have the language of emotions. I know that the next book that I'm scheming up with Lauren's help is an activity book for brave parents. And one of the activities I think about is playing charades with emotions, right?
Yeah.
Them out and trying to get, you know, family members or friends to guess what emotions those are, and the subtleties among all the different emotions help build a vocabulary around listening to their feelings.
Something that might be a nice add-on to that is the sort of alternate activity for your less extroverted children is drawing it. So I'm very extroverted, like 90% or higher on the scales every time. Yeah, I know, it's surprising. Shock and awe. And I often have just phenomenal introverts on my team who remind me that not everyone likes to stand up in front of audiences and do things. So I offer that to you as an option for children. I think it's important for us to also empower them to be their true selves and to not always feel that's something that as a society, and especially in business, we reward people for extroversion, and we almost, you know, stigmatize introversion and shyness. And I think that's something that a lot of people have to, I have those conversations with students a lot, really overcoming trauma that's associated with them being told they're not good enough because they're not outgoing enough, extroverted enough. And so I offer that as a possible alternative option for that activity in the book.
Yeah.
My introverted self appreciates that.
Yeah.
What we do know is that kids that are able to have the gumption to ask questions, get their questions answered. Mm-hmm. And that can be helpful for kids in terms of learning.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
I am curious, though, because we were talking earlier about, you know, when the kids do have their own ideas to do things that we know might cause them harm and not really listening to us. I mean, we spoke earlier in the introduction about the other side of punishing or consequences, and I am very intrigued about what you teach behind that.
Yeah. I think the most important thing, and this has been such an amazing takeaway from going with this ungraded format, is we are conditioned our whole lives from the time that we start compulsory education to perform for rewards and perform to avoid punishments. And we lose sight, we lose complete connection with our intrinsic motivation, what motivates us intrinsically. And figuring that out for ourselves is really important. Helping our kids identify that for themselves is also critically important. So what we know about grades, decades of educational psych data, is that the more we grade or evaluate someone's performance, the less they learn. It's inversely related. And I've seen in, you know, lots of parenting and respectful parenting, gentle parenting approaches, that's really the same. It's the other side of the coin, right? That we're also, when we're doing this respectful parenting and listening to them, that we're helping them discover that agency and discover what does motivate them to stay alive or healthy or well, because they don't know those things. But the best thing that we can do as an educator of 18, 19, 20 year olds, but then also raising a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, is helping to inspire people to see what could matter to them. Because if you don't know that it exists and you don't understand that, you know, you're never going to run as fast as a car could go or whatever, right? Back to that example, that we need to educate and inspire rather than reward or punish.
Well, and the idea that we teach responsibility to ourselves so that we're not just talking about running in front of cars, but, you know, healthy sexual play that's protected, that, you know, experimenting with drugs and alcohol, these are later things that you mm-hmm. really don't want your kids haphazardly doing.
Yeah.
Right. You'd like to be able to protect them. You know that they are going to have to make decisions for themselves. And how do we instill that with, you know, Jim Fay would say, rather have them crash their first tricycle than their first car.
Yeah.
We have to teach
yeah.
that level of personal responsibility. I was very influenced when Hunter was young, when they were your kids' age, with and Amy knows this, by the book Punished by Rewards and also the Green Marker Study. And I'm probably going to botch the Green Marker Study because it's years since I've looked at it, but it's like a couple of classrooms and they gave markers to one classroom and another they gave markers, and the kids in the control group got to just play with the markers, and the kids in the other group got rewarded if they used the green markers, and for they had an extrinsic reward for how many things they could put out with these green markers. So the kids in the other classroom were super jealous that these kids were getting all this. I don't remember what the reward was. It was candy or money or whatever, yeah. But they just really put it out there, you know, and months later they brought the markers back, because the markers then left the classroom. They brought them back, and it turned out the kids that were working in the green marker study group, now there were no more rewards. They really left the markers away. The other kids who had been able to just play with the markers at will were so excited that the markers were back. Now, this is a long time ago, and magic markers sure. were magic.
But they were a big thing.
They were a big thing. Now we have tablets.
But I was going to say it would be tablets now.
But the point was, it influenced me because I started thinking, you know, we really decidedly didn't pay Hunter for chores. Mm-hmm. The keeping a household clean and safe was our family responsibility. And yes. we made it kind of fun, put some music on, clean the house together, teach how to do that rather than, and we still wanted him to have some money to be able to learn to manage, to buy, make his own choices on toys. So he wasn't asking us for things. I really did not want any of that. So I gave him an allowance, $1 per his age per week. Now, many families can't afford to do that, but I would say $5 a week is a lot. He had to learn to, we tithed it. We took 10% and saved for a children's charity. And we had a charity book that we looked at, and he was saving for a tree for, you know, we were doing some interesting things managing his money. You know, we're able to open up a bank account. When he ruined something in the home, he had money to pay for it. So there were all kinds of ways that we could use the money, but the money was a gift for him to manage it, not because he earned it for doing things inside the house. Now, we went outside the house to take care of his neighbor's thing. Some of it was a neighborly act, and some of it he could decide to get paid for later, but, you know, mowing grass and things like that. But in our house, I didn't want to pay my son to clean his room or clean a bathroom. So that was kind of an interesting approach. And again, everybody has their own.
Something that you said, and I agree, we really have lost the sense of responsibility to community. So much of our societal messaging is this rugged individualism, and everybody, it's every person for themselves. And yeah, gross. And when we think, so this is something that I regularly say to the kids too. And Olivia's
your
really,
kids or your college?
My kids. And Olivia's really starting to understand we need to take care of our community. So you could want to do probably the thing that they do the most is just being loud. Like you're screaming at the top of your lungs. If you want to do that, can you go someplace where you're not affecting everyone else in our, I refer to it as our community, because I want them thinking about not just our family, but anywhere we go, right? We're in community with people in different spaces, in different ways, and how we're influencing people matters. And so not that we're neglecting our own needs at the expense of other people at all times, but that we're always mindful of that. How are we showing up for ourselves and in community with other people? And those are going to sometimes create conflict for us that we can talk about, right? But I really want to be loud right now at a restaurant. Okay, well, then we're going to need to leave because these people did not come here to listen to kids screaming while they were eating their dinner.
We have to look at our impact and see if it's intended or unintended, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
how it impacts, you know, ultimately us again.
Something as you were talking about pay and that sort of thing and the intrinsic motivation thing just triggered, like, for me, something that I figured out with my kids, like the most important compensation of any kind is my time. Like that's the most important thing that I can give them is my time. And I don't know why it took me so long. I might be a little dense, but you know, 4.5 years in, and I finally said, you know, I was getting frustrated at the messes that they were making behind me as I was cleaning. And I would always say, don't make messes. It's making more work for me. And it was about me, right? And finally, one day I said, hey, you know, the more messes that you make, the less time that I have to spend with you. And it was like, boom, light bulb went on for Olivia. And she started helping me clean up what had just happened because she wanted to spend time together. So then, of course, naturally, I had to make sure that I also did that. I didn't use the extra time to do other things, which I did want to do, but really me paying attention to, you know, what really motivates them is getting to spend time with me, which I can appreciate that that's not going to be forever. And so that's not going to be the thing. I know that. But for now, that's one of the ways that I found to tap into their intrinsic motivation is
I love that.
Hey, if we can all do this thing together, we can all go do something really cool
more
together.
Time.
Yeah. One thing that I find interesting though, just based off what you said, it might not always be the case that they want to spend time with me, but now I'm thinking about your classes and what you're helping these college students recognize. And I almost wonder if we were all raised with this awareness early on, if maybe there wasn't necessarily an ending like we expect around 8, 9, 10 years old, right?
Yeah. I hope so.
I think it came to my mind.
Yeah.
I also, you know, we don't have enough time to do everything I wanted to do today, but I wanted to also really just touch on racism, sexism, and how to raise kids who are learning to judge 1% less every day of their life, which is what I am in the process of doing my whole life. Mm-hmm. And when I said that to my son, he was like, well, mom, you know, how is it
going to be?
You're not very judgmental. And I was like, listen, 1% of 1% is 0.01 and 0.01, it's infinite. And it's not just how we portray our lack of judgment on the outside, but what do we say in our mind before the words come out? Mm-hmm. Do I really judge this person? Mm-hmm. And the difference between maintaining safety, having to make a snap judgment about the fact that the burner's hot, don't put your, or you're walking down in a dark alley and that guy doesn't look safe, mm-hmm. and making a generalization about their person. Mm-hmm. Those are tough decisions when you want your kids to stay safe and have a little bit of stranger danger, mm-hmm. that they're not, you know, running off in somebody's car going, you look like a nice person. And they're gone. So, you know, that's maybe a subject for another day, but can you touch on it a little bit? How do we help kids grow up in seeing the world as much bigger than our own focus?
I'm going to bring it back to the parents on this one. I just, in fact, I wrote a chapter in a book called Embody Kind, and it's titled Patriarchy Free Parenting. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, you know, if we're perpetuating these norms and beliefs and we're modeling judgment and othering without realizing it. So again, it's our own mindfulness and our own unlearning and our own commitment to judging less, and seeing the humanity, centering the humanity. My goal is to model that so that my kids will call me out if I do it. Because, you know, we were raised differently. We were raised in a different time. And I think one of the general guidelines and principles in our house is we don't comment on people's bodies, faces, physical appearance. If someone's got a cute outfit, totally fine, right? Because that's an expression of themselves, but we don't comment on people's physical appearance and their bodies, because why do we need to do that? And that's really led to some interesting conversations with family members. I'm going to leave it at that. But I think that and calling out behaviors of other people. So modeling not only how we show up, but how we call other people in and have those discussions about, yeah, hey, we don't do that here, because that's also modeling something that's
so different. It's so interesting. I remember something so impactful when I was young, probably Olivia's age. My brother's a year older, and we were in a grocery store, and he said to my mom something about that woman in the aisle as a fatso. And in the, you know, this is, you know, 50 years ago, when people were by and large thinner anyway. So an unusually large person. And we got into the car, and my mom, the therapist, turned around and said, you know, and she's talking to kids about this. She said, you know, I want you to know that although she looks different from you and it's unusual and you want to comment on it, she said, I want you to know that people who are heavy, what I have noticed is that they create a heaviness or a distance between their heart and another person because they're afraid to get close, and you're making it harder for them to get close. Aww. And I was like, oh, that's so sad. So she said, never want to do that. But she would take like individual responses that we had. We had two gay men married living next door to us. And my son, when he was little, was like, that must be really, they're both named Bob. And she said, and Hunter was like, Bob and Bob, that must be very hard for the woman of the house. And we had to explain that there was no woman in the house, and that, you know, that they chose to have a relationship sort of like a man. And, you know, all of these messages, when you think about how they're brand new to kids, mm-hmm. how we do it without going, shame on you for they don't know that mm-hmm. what they said was inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Shame on you, shame on you, shame on you. Mm-hmm. Instead, it is to say, you know, here's what I've learned, and, you know, in a very kind way, and here's why we don't treat people that way and make them feel awkward because they choose to live their life, or, you know, they're different from us. Yeah. So those messages are impactful. You remember, I remember when I was little going, wow, I never thought.
Wow. Well, and that's, to me, I think if we're always focused on centering humanity, centering our kindness and empathy and compassion for ourselves and for other people, we're focused on what matters instead of if you think of how does society define a good kid versus a bad kid, it's about obedience and following rules. And that will just take a whole other podcast for us to discuss, but
and it'd be worth it, wouldn't it, Lauren? We have to have her back.
I just never want this to end. Can we
I know we're hanging on every word. And we will.
Oh, and Amy, when's that book coming out so the audience can read?
Yeah, Embody Kind is releasing September 26th, so next Monday.
Wow.
And yep, so it'll
you
be out.
You have one chapter in that, right?
I have one chapter in that, and then I have a collaborative book, The Rebellion, Transforming Society with Radical Authenticity. Ooh. And I have 22 authors. And myself and an anti-bias consultant who's going to be helping us really shape our words in a way so we can do no harm and really help people see themselves in the stories and connect better with their authenticity, hopefully, with their stories. And all the proceeds of that book are going to go to support the organizations each of the authors are highlighting in their chapters.
It's amazing.
And I love your work, and I can't wait to see your own book too.
I know. I'm excited to write that. Here's
to it. I love you and you too, Lauren. So this is a really, really privilege for me to have spent this last hour. And I know we need to wrap it up, unfortunately, but we're going to do it again.
Yes, please. I love that.
You have such a big following. Do you want to tell people how to find you?
You know, probably the best way to find me is at Rebel Professor on Instagram. And this is probably a bold move, but Amy Weisner on TikTok. I don't really do a whole lot on TikTok yet, but I'm kind of thinking that I want to, because I like talking. Go figure. And one of the things that's cool about that platform is that people kind of have dialogue, because they'll ask questions in the comments, or sometimes it's not questions. And then the rebellion.online is the community that I'm building to help people.
And your really... Facebook?
Yeah. Facebook is my name, Amy Weisner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. And
yeah.
And hopefully you'll share this podcast and we'll get more brave parent.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
More people to our podcast.
Sounds great.
What an incredible time today, Amy. Thank you so much for lending us your time and your expertise. And
it's been a pleasure. I look forward to the next time.
Yes.
Me too. Thank you both.
Bye.
Stay tuned for our very next podcast. Thank you for listening to the Brave Parent Podcast with your host, Dr. Susan Maples, author of Brave Parent, and Lauren Eckert, founder of Burning Soul Press. Be sure to leave a podcast review and grab your copy of Brave Parent on Amazon or Audible or wherever you choose to buy your books. Bye for now.